So before we begin the show, we want to tell you about our Patreon, which we're launching, which is at patreon.com/about_buildings. George, why are we doing this?
We started a couple of years ago, nearly. Not for you, but for us anyway. We still feel that there are big limitations on what we can do, and there are things that are very frustrating.
We are hoping to be able to do a bit less other stuff, to keep the wolf from the door, and a little more of this to bump up the quality, and so we're asking you for some money.
We're not proposing to change the formula, but we would like to increase the quality and the frequency of what we're doing. If you go onto Patreon, you can sign up. It's $3 per month. Well, you can say something. We've recorded this whole thing to the background of an extremely noisy truck outside the window, which is good.
It's very... You'll be very familiar with that by now.
Very atmospheric. It's $3 a month. In return, you'll get a bit of bonus audio. In my mind, it's the highest level of the kind of mountain of enlightenment that we're ascending during the course of the episode. And the summit, the real kind of God's view, will be for those that pay.
You're like a big promiser, aren't you? I'm not sure there's that much wisdom
in... That's not a promise. That was a vision.
That was a vision of how it would be.
That was a vision.
Only the patrons...
Yeah, the patrons... The Thetan Mark II,
yes,
or whatever.
Yeah. I was thinking of the Scientology analogy. Yeah. Like, full operating Thetan status,
yeah,
will only be for the $3... $3 American dollar per month tier. Anyway, so there'll be more information on the Patreon. It's patreon.com/about_buildings.
Oh, there's one other thing I wanted to say. Thank you very much, everybody, for listening. I'm tremendously appreciative and enduringly surprised, actually. When we first started putting them out, you'd get about 30 downloads an episode, and we sort of knew who a lot of those people were. A lot of them were bots, and the rest of them were like our parents and immediate friends. But now there are thousands. There are like plausible thousands. Not when I first started saying that, it's because there were like 2,000, but it's quite a lot now. Yeah, it's very surprising, and it's gone better than I thought it would.
Thank you all very much. So check it out, patreon.com/about_buildings. All right. Architectural history, as written and taught in the Western world, has never been concerned with more than a few select cultures. In terms of space, it comprises but a small part of the globe, Europe, stretches of Egypt and Anatolia, or little more than was known in the 2nd century AD. Skipping the first 50 centuries, chroniclers present us with a full-dress pageant of formal architecture, as arbitrary a way of introducing the art of building as, say, dating the birth of music with the advent of the symphony orchestra. It amounts to little more than a who's who of architects who commemorated power and wealth, an anthology of buildings of, by, and for the privileged, the houses of true and false gods, of merchant princes and princes of the blood, with never a word about the houses of lesser people. Architecture Without Architects attempts to break down our narrow concepts of the art of building by introducing the unfamiliar world of non-pedigreed architecture. It is so little known that we don't even have a name for it. For want of a generic label, we shall call it vernacular, anonymous, spontaneous, indigenous, rural, as the case may be. That's a quotation from the introduction to Architecture Without Architects, the book produced as a tie-in for the 1964 exhibition curated by Bernard Radofsky at the Museum of Modern Art in New York in 1964. Later on, Radofsky would recall that when he first proposed an exhibition of vernacular architecture in the early 1940s, the idea had been politely ignored, although MoMA were happy to take possession of his collection of black and white photographs. They simply buried them in the archives. Even in 1964, he later claimed, the idea of the exhibition was simply not respectable. And until the opinion of various late modernist cognoscenti had been sought and their approval gained, the exhibition could not go ahead. Fortunately, architects like José Luis Sert, Kenzo Tange and Richard Neutra, who Rudofsky consulted at the time, were all supportive. It was a success in its own terms. It has had a long afterlife through the success of the book produced alongside it. It's still in print today. Well, what can you say? It's frequently read by architecture students, and it's a sort of...
Cultured uncles or equivalent will give it to young prospective architecture students. It's got various qualities which make it seem... It's sort of studiously black and white, full bleed, tasteful in that sort of 60s way, but also broadly accessible. Yeah. And deals with attempts to inculcate a culture that respects various things that are thought to be good.
Difference, curiosity.
Broadening of horizons and expansion of the frame of view of architects. So it's regarded both as an attractive but also as a good piece of propaganda for...
Yeah, it's funny you say that. The copy I have in front of me, which is my girlfriend's, was indeed given to her by a cultured uncle when she... began university.
Well, there we go.
Yeah, when we moved in together, it was one of the few books which we had two copies of.
So it's a famous work, and a number of you will have heard of it. We know that because we said we were going to do it, and lots of people said that's good.
Yeah, I think it's a much loved sort of source book among many architects and designers, and its author Bernard Rudofsky, who we're going to also talk about a bit. Yeah, a very fascinating character, rather attractive in a certain way. As a person with a diverse set of interests, he aligns quite strongly with the ethos or image of the podcast in a certain way. He was kind of a bon viveur in the sense that he was very concerned with the idea of what it meant to live a good, fruitful, sensuous and enjoyable life. Highly idiosyncratic, with a broad set of interests which were very much kind of his own. I think he would always play up a little bit his own kind of iconoclasm or eccentricity, wouldn't you say?
This book and the work that went with it was a long time in coming. You will have heard almost exactly the same story with sort of slight different changes, but there's some very strong leitmotifs in the build-up to this that you have heard with other people we've dealt with. And it fits, interestingly, within a cosmology of architectural eccentrics. I think we both agree the strongest work is the book Architecture Without Architects. Now, that's not to say there isn't a lot of other interesting things, but I think first we should go to the book, and then we can discuss and what it means in a greater context. The book, at least in the sort of early incarnations, is a black and white paperback, shorter than A4, about 5'4" portrait, I'd say. It's got a full bleed, enigmatic black and white image on the front with the title Architecture Without Architects. And the majority of the book on the inside is either full bleed or large black and white images, mainly photographs, often take at funny angles of largely unpopulated vernacular architecture, stretching the definition of architecture right to the limit. It can be sticks on a mound, but a lot of it is also Italian villages.
What he means by architecture without architects, it's very broad, but it does have certain exclusions. One is that it's things which are outside of the sort of heroic canon of architectural history, your kind of classic architecture history survey course going back through sort of up until the ancient Egyptians or wherever those sorts of things would tend to begin. The other half of it is that they are things which are broadly non-metropolitan, broadly non-urban, although that's a little bit dicey, and that they are sort of untouched by broader networks of like industrial distribution. So that they tend to have a strongly autochthonous character, in the sense that the resources which have been used to make them have had to come from extremely close to wherever they are.
There are lots of exceptions. If I wanted to be unkind, I would say that the only thing that really unites them is they're things that he liked.
Yeah.
You can describe the exhibition.
The design of the book is very much in harmony with its presentation in the exhibition. There's a photograph which you have, and the I think it's quite a fun era of exhibition design, this. It's very sort of stark, very abstract. There are lots of these vertical black, very thin columns, which the photographs are applied to framelessly, and they run over one or more of... They sort of run over the column grid. Sometimes they run over a single bay of the column grid. Sometimes they run over more than one bay. And so the grid of the columns is a little bit like a sort of visualization of the column grid, which you have in quite a lot of graphic design layouts of the time. I'd say it looks a bit more restrained in the book than it was in the exhibition. We'll get more into his career as a curator, but this was by no means the first exhibition which he'd organised for MoMA, and he'd been doing it for more than 20 years, actually.
At MoMA, he'd been doing it for 20 years, but he'd done exhibitions before then. I think we could talk about the images.
Yeah, we should say something about the images, which is that although Rudofsky was a keen and, I think, pretty talented photographer, the images are by no means all his. Lots of them are old. Some of them are copied from books. He talks about at various times having got some of them from the collections of other people. But so much of what they document may have no longer existed at the time that it was on display.
Most of it still does, although the lifestyle that accompanies it, I would say, has been degraded very greatly. So there's a short essay at the beginning, and it is short. It's a few thousand words. There's various little notes, and then it's quickly into the body, which isn't divided up by chapter, but may as well be, in that it is divided by type. Some of the sections are much longer than others, and each section, type section, will have a short commentary on it. But mainly it is just drawing together from as global a reference he can types of buildings. So the first one is amphitheatres. But there are long sections on things like granaries, cemeteries, fortifications, and then within that there are sub sort of results. But within, rather than being a type as a building, it's more like a type of shape. So he has granaries that look like graveyards, graveyards that are granaries, graveyards that are fortifications, defensive towers that look like dovecotes. He does have houses, although not very many, and the ones that he does deal with are exceptional in general. At the end, he has people moving one on their backs. One is being carried. There are also lots of pictures of sort of Italian towns, very interested in arcades, covered streets. And then there are things which are really not very architectural, like, you know, the posts in vineyards or just posts in the ground. So he's really wanting to stretch it. And it's very exciting looking through it. It says on the front, architecture, and then the image at the front is extremely enigmatic. It's an inverted black and white image that we discover later is of these terraces with posts around Lake Garda. But it is very, very ambiguous what it is when you see it on the front. And that ambiguity, combined with the word architecture, is exciting because it expands away from the mundane, away from humdrum modernism, what architecture can mean. And I think that's one of the things that he's finding very exciting.
The book begins with what are essentially landforms, these strange circular terraces from Peru, these kind of grave landscapes.
Oh, there's this really funny, there's the French, where they're the rows of standing stones, which were subsequently reorganised by Victor by 18th century people to be in nice, neat rows.
A bit slightly tidied up. Yeah, Karnak, which is a famous...
Most of them fell down, and they probably weren't ever in rows like that.
Yeah, and then I think this, which is one of the strangest ones, is the Ordex Necropolis, a sort of like mound with lots of dead trees stuck in it.
Clearly once it was ceremonial tumuli grave with some sort of, I think it looks to me like there's two stockade like patterns of sticks that were there originally, but as time has worn it away, it's become eroded and fallen down, and it's been left with what is a very ambiguous sort of story about materials.
Rudofsky is much more excited about the as found and somewhat a kind of transformed condition, this sort of enigmatic sculptural thing which has come to be, than any sort of imaginative reconstruction of what the thing might have been like originally or what it might have been for.
For Without Architects, in the title, really is about the way of looking. It's making explicit the intent that obviously these people were designed, these things were designed by people, and a lot of them were designed by people who were highly specialised and educated in what they were doing and deeply technical. But he's not interested in that. He is interested in the objects as sculptural found forms which are isolated from culture. He's not interested in local cultures in this book. He's not interested in the anthropology, only in the universal sculptural form of these types and the expansion of the view of architecture. And once you understand that project, what is going on in the book becomes much more clear. That really it is a collection of images based on a way of viewing.
Well, it's a kind of a wonder cabinet, isn't it?
But it doesn't have the heteroclite quality. A wonder cabinet will have artifacts of nature, crystals, dinosaurs' bones, carefully carved things. Sure, they're put together regardless of origins, but this has...
Doesn't this have that? I mean, this has got natural, it's got things not made by people.
They're all made by people at some point.
If you look at the book which he followed it with, which is the Prodigious Builders, which is his opportunity to go a bit wilder, it's full of things made by animals as well as people. It has natural geological formations in it as well. I think that the thing about this way of looking is that it doesn't necessarily, they don't have to be made by people, or they can be made by masses of people over very long time scales. What they're valued for is often their strangeness. It's not necessarily that they meet a series of pre-existing models, because he's always open to the existence of, like, another one. There are definitely types which emerge.
There are a couple of things that there aren't any of. There are a lot of images of people, but there are no discernible faces. They're always turned away. There are no images of the interiors of rooms. Essentially, you know, with their accompanying bits of domesticity or everyday life or industry, the images of buildings that are on their own, a single image dead on of a building, are of things like round towers with no doors, very blank castles with no apertures. But anything which has got doors and windows that are discernible will be seen en masse. It's a great, great collection of them. And his very favourite things are essentially storage, because they're blank shapes. He's got that kind of Corby liking the collection of forms. Oh, and also he takes pictures from strange angles, very partial to an aerial picture from a plane. Photographs that are framed in such a way as to produce an extreme degree of abstraction, in such a way that it distorts. You wouldn't see it like that when you were there.
So after that, we get onto one of his real favourites, which is living underground, like whole hillsides covered in openings of troglodyte dwellings.
Yeah, I've been there. That's just Neolithic tombs. There's nothing in it. The black dots, the cavity behind it is about the same size as the dot.
Yeah.
It's Stone Age tombs. He says they're made into, converted into houses in the Middle Ages. Almost none were. Like, I expect a few were used as, like, shepherd huts or something.
This is one of the really amazing ones of these houses in China with their sunken courtyards.
This is this very interesting terrain they've got where, in the really old bit of China, around the bend of the Yellow River, yeah, Dust blows in off the desert. And it's very spiky dust. It's not like river sand. It's called loess. And it builds up and up and up and up. And it's very, very good for making tamped earth. And also, it's very, you can just cut it like a saw, but it's very soft. Yeah. And so you have all these this architectural type, which is made by excavating and cutting away these loess mounds.
It's like a courtyard house, but everything is underground. And so what's exposed is this square hole, which goes right down into the earth, and which is the courtyard of the house, and off which all of the rooms are these excavated openings.
And there's a whole load of pictures of this. He really likes it.
He's a great propagandist for underground living. As we'll see in a bit, this is partly that he'd written his thesis about these sort of semi-troglodyte dwellings in Greece, and had obviously acquired early on a very strong belief that they'd been unfairly maligned. So he says here that they are clean and free from vermin.
They're also unbelievably grim in some other places. There used to be saw makers in Cumbria, weren't there? Gypsy saw makers who lived in a giant sort of cave hacked, but also in extraordinary poverty. It doesn't tend to be something people do when they can... The Laos example is a bit of an exception because it's a very, very dry climate with a river running through it, so you can do agriculture as well. And it's a very rare, unusual thing, which is extremely convenient for this. And you were saying he's drawn to troglodytic life. I think he is, but he's also drawn to other forms. But he also is a great believer that people shouldn't stay in one place. Cities should, he says, in other places should no longer stay static, or that they won't in the future somehow. And in a way, he's interested, it's part of seeing an alternative possibility and then extending it.
So then you have these ones are purely geological formations. The Ciudad Encantada, which is a sort of geological deposit. And then there's a baobab tree, which has been hollowed out, or he says is sometimes hollowed out to create a dwelling.
No, this one hasn't. He just says that you could hollow it out.
I mean, and they are rather amazing forms. I mean, the baobab is an amazing looking thing. This sort of enormous, like, elephantine...
Well, the quality of images in this is really high.
Then here's one which he comes back to at other times, which are these famous tufa, like, cone cave dwellings in Anatolia, in modern-day Turkey, in a place called, was it Gurime?
There's the Ethiopian cut-out churches, which are by now rather famous.
Yeah, the famous churches at Lalibela. Yes, all looking suitably sculptural.
Then we have agricultural. So we have a very interesting, it looks like a picture of a model almost of Chinese terracing, and then various things to catch earth to make fields. He doesn't have the amazing ones on St. Kilda.
Oh, yeah.
Most extraordinary. A lot of these are accompanied by extraordinary human hardship and poverty. The one St. Kilda is where the whole island was covered in dry stone walls because all of the soil was blown off the island all the time. And they'd pile up kelp and then grow things in the kelp behind these dry stone walls. That sort of thing where you've got the collections of dry stone walls which are to either hold back or retain earth. Again, making beautiful images in a landscape. But the next ones appear to be of Santorini.
Yes, these little white towns of barrel vaulted dwellings. He has this thing where he says that a town, what is it? Oh yeah, a town that aspires to being a work of art should be just as finite as a painting. So it's kind of important that these are little towns where you can see the edge. They have this very spectacular relationship to an often very dramatic landscape, but they don't stretch off into the distance. They are condensed and often quite sort of fortified.
A funny thing to say, a town that aspires to be a work of art should be as finite as a painting, which really re-emphasises the project, doesn't it? Because towns don't aspire to be works of art, by and large. They are very dense, either for reasons of fortification or because it's necessary to have everything close together for utility. They're not like that for aesthetic purposes. But he's interested in the image.
So there's this wonderful image of Anticolo Corrado, which is this lovely image. It has a really good like foreground background thing where I feel like someone must have done like a sort of dodge or something. The background is so sort of fading into the mist. It's number 36.
They do look surprisingly like that sometimes, but the quality of the black and white photography really emphasizes it.
He's very interested in towns as organic wholes. The image of the collective. And there's a bunch of those. There's some nice ones in Spain.
After general description of towns, which are often about the towns on a hill or the collection, the aesthetic property of the collection of houses in a landscape, the next section is towns that are fortified, which actually a lot of the first ones are. I'm conflicted now because I think there's a really complicated stories about why he's into various these things, which I feel could operate at several levels. So we, as we are describing, he's obviously into the aesthetic properties of this of these towns on their hills or huddling up against their bluffs, their curious cylindrical houses with pointy roofs or whatever. And then we come onto these fortified towns, and he's interested into the aesthetics of the fortification. So, you know, fortified places. Grown-up people have been known to be in raptures over the aesthetic adventures afforded by the split-level house, which suggests they've never quite been able to leave the ground in our modest flights of architectural fancy. And then he's saying, you know, these fortified towns are much more exciting in their split levels, which is a very strange thing to say, that, like, these people have built essentially these castles in the desert to defend this tiny surplus, and that what's interesting about it is that they employ split-level architecture, which at one level is really a profoundly strange thing to say from someone who fled the Nazis, lived through the air war, lived through, went to Japan after the nuclear attacks. I mean, a while after, but is aware, seems to have some aware of this sort of troglodytic existence or its potential in the kind of post-age of air war.
Yeah.
And yet he's got a whole big series of fortified dwellings, which are analysed entirely, in the pictures, entirely in an aesthetic sense from the point of view of them from the outside, and in the writing are analysed for their aesthetic potential, also including the person moving around inside them, and comparing them to the way people talk about, like, suburban American houses. And this duality exists in the earlier ones, because he's very... the other theme, as well as his very broad definition of vernacular architecture that goes through his life, is building in supporting and shaping a lifestyle, and a lifestyle that is universal, not modern, sensual, elemental and bodily pleasures. There are multiple impulses, but there also is a strong, willful elision, obfuscation. Part of the thing that makes the book, and the reason why discussing the physical quality of the book so attractive, is its expansion or reframing of architecture. But that reframing has some very strange qualities to do with life, what generates these things. And I think fortification is a really clear example of that. It's better to... He seems to be saying it's better to live in a fortified town in Mali, on the edge of civilization, or wherever it is, because of its aesthetic properties, than to live in American suburbia.
But everything is very, is like highly ironic, isn't it?
It's sort of sarcastic, actually.
Yeah. One of the narratives running through this whole thing, which at a quite basic level, is that maybe civilization isn't all it's cracked up to be. And that's a sort of a point which is made repeatedly, playfully, in different ways. And I think that there is kind of an enjoyment of making these quite sort of silly jokes about contemporary fashion.
Proper weird, right after the Cuban Missile Crisis, to go, we shouldn't live in houses, we should all live underground.
But he's not saying that. I think that it's like, it's a real mistake to try to distill, like, a Rudofsky manifesto out of this. Because there isn't one. In one of the books which we read, I was thinking about this, in one of the books that we read on this, the Lessons from Bernard Rudofsky, Life as a Journey.
This is a useful reader on his, which came out a few years ago, instantaneously went out of print, is now very handily on Amazon for $1,500, having previously cost like 25 or something.
You could quibble with various things in the book, but the title, I think, is absolutely correct, because he's constantly in motion. He has this sort of permanently critical and questioning posture, but he's not using that to, except in certain quite personal ways, which maybe we'll go into a little bit more later, he's not using that to assemble a, like, manifesto. He's not using that to assemble a vision of how the world should be or how everyone should live. It would be a huge mistake to say that, oh, Bernard Rudofsky thinks everyone should live underground because he says caves are so wonderful, because he doesn't really think that. But everything, and he enjoys the provocation. That's the mode that he works through, sort of writing to the pictures, isn't he? And he's saying that there is, he talks about labyrinths. It's all very romantic. He's kind of he's romancing what's already in the image and kind of adding another level of narration. Often it looks initially as if there's no one in the picture, But then after a little while, you realise there is one or maybe two people in the corner of the picture. And that's, I think, is the ideal...
Tiny and blurred.
Yeah, yeah, tiny little person. Often going, you know, they may be like in the act of coming out of a doorway or something like that. Yeah, these ones, the ones in the Caucasus are amazing. These ones where every single house has a sort of fortified tower attached to it. I think the big part of the pleasure of this is the kind of the pleasure of the miniature, isn't it? It's like this perverse town condition where everything is a monumental building but a tiny one.
You've got these in a lot of places without strong states. This type of like very tall, thin houses with no windows on the first three floors. And the ones on the upper floors look very much like the sort of window you poke a gun out of. Right after that, he's onto arcades and covered streets, which have the examples you'll be familiar with in Mediterranean.
Yeah, so the arcade one, I think, is where he gets closest to a sort of broader critique of modernism, which is going on in terms of like traditional architecture, townscape, the sort of history of European architecture and these kinds of things. These are recognisably urban typologies that can be worked with or assimilated into contemporary architecture in different ways and would be.
Amusingly, they also contain images from his childhood.
Oh, yeah, of course. Here we've got Moravia.
Yeah, and there's several Moravian ones.
Sweet, yes.
There's one image which is perfectly picturesque. She's a long... There's a lot of very extreme crops. So, you know, there's a lot of ones that are three times as wide as they're tall or vice versa.
Yeah.
And it's this view of shadow, this line of shadows down a long arcade where you can't really see anything. And there's a dog and a partially obscured silhouette of a man.
Yes, that one's very romantic, isn't it?
They're all very romantic.
A couple of pages further on, this is one of the things which he discovered while travelling and essentially adopted as a really neat gadget, which is the temporary street covering in sunny weather. These like fabric things which can be stretched across the street, which they have in Seville and in various places in Africa. He doesn't say where.
They also existed in Japan.
And then a little bit further on, there are these... I meant to say that that's something which he would propose quite a lot in his own architecture, were these outdoor rooms with covered courtyards, or courtyards which could be covered by these fabric shades. I think he's very interested in that type of space, I think, was a particular fascination for him, which could be moderated.
Yeah, the street that becomes slowly indoors through covering, you know, the corridor street or the corridor courtyard. He's not quite naff enough to say he's interested in awnings, but he is.
Yeah, he is. He does like them. The more you read of him, the more you realise that as soon as he reaches a certain sort of fixed point or resolution, he then has to kind of move on and find something wrong with it or find some kind of critique. So in Architecture Without Architects, there's this picture of this famous Greek monastery, the monastery of Simon Petra on Mount Athos, which has these amazing, like utterly terrifying loggia balconies which are cantilevered out of the front of this very sort of towering stone mass. Then when he writes about Mount Athos in The Prodigious Builders, which is the sort of follow-up and expansion that he wrote, I think, about 15 years later, he's incredibly rude about them. It's very funny.
He's incredibly rude about everyone.
Da-da-da-da-da. So he talks about it as one of the few places on Earth that haven't suffered from the blight of organised tourism and are still safe from the scheming of travel agents. But then he says, its trifling population, whose number has dwindled from 40,000 in the 16th century to a few hundred, and the low density of construction would make it the most desirable place to live in this side of heaven, were it not that its inhabitants are a mirthless and misogynous band of men, ill-disposed towards life's pleasures. They are monks who thrive on prayer and little else.
And who'd have thought it was a bunch of misogynist men who went to the island where not even female animals are allowed?
Yeah.
Everywhere he goes, he just piles on sarcasm about his hosts, basically. Yeah.
But that doesn't mean he doesn't love those places.
No, he does. He just hates all the people. not hates, but he just reflexively, like, the arc of his life, he is rude. He is rude about the Moravians. He is rude about the Austrians. He is rude about the Greeks and the Italians. He is rude about the Americans. He is rude about the urban Americans. He is rude about the rural Americans. He goes to Japan. He is sarcastic about the Japanese. He comes back from Japan and he continues to be sarcastic about the Americans.
But I think it's also a performance. Like, I don't think it's reflective of a sort of... he doesn't really hate them. It's just... he's just being funny. I think it's a kind of a... I think he always has to distance himself from everything in some way. The way in which he kind of is able to break open and understand these things is by a certain kind of rhetorical violence. What else have we got? Yeah, then you've got all your granaries,
loads of cool granaries,
good looking
granaries.
Yeah, bizarre things, some great ones in various parts of Africa. Whatever he thinks of people, he loves anthropomorphic buildings, doesn't he? These like big bulbous mud buildings on legs with their little straw hats.
He much prefers some dead people in funny boxes though to live ones.
I don't know about that. We'll see. Because the thing is, there's a sort of framing which is that his reputation... this is one of the things which is strange. His reputation is very much as like a humanist architect. He's humane. He's very concerned with a certain conception, a certain like primal conception of humanity, which is quite universal. I mean, we've alluded to the organisation of the book and the way that it doesn't separate things out by culture or any kind of like genealogy or kind of historical continuity or whatever. But I think it's partly because he's disenchanted and trying to open people's eyes to the kind of disenchanting effect of modern life. It's expressed through this sarcasm and this kind of critique, but I think it is motivated by a kind of humane instinct, isn't it? Although it's a little bit perverse.
What he doesn't like is he doesn't like any cultures, but he likes the idea of people.
I want to talk about this beautiful, amazing, like huge water wheel.
Actually, they were a Roman invention, but they then existed. They went off into Syria and Africa, and these huge water wheels and this engineering without engineers. These are massive, and they are the way the water wheel works. When they're working, the one that he's got a picture of here is actually broken, is that you have an aqueduct and you have a slow-moving river and a water wheel, which is powered by the river, to lift water into the aqueduct. Yeah. As I said, I think these were a Roman invention, or they were certainly made in the Roman Empire, and then sort of were improved and developed. And they're amazing-looking things.
It's so big, yeah.
But he's so... engineering without engineers is just because that's what he wants it to be. The people who built and designed these were incredibly trained engineers who were... you can't come up with that in one go. It's a massive feat of both the concentration of labour and technical skill to make these things work. And they were iteratively designed over years by people passing on information with developed skills in a culture, and it is absolutely, and it's a technology. It's technology and culture is actually what it is. It isn't at all engineering without engineers. It's just that they're dead and gone and were only written about sparingly, but it's the fruit of hundreds of years of technological development. And then he's looking at it as this sort of aesthetic object.
It's a wonderful photo. There's this tiny, naked little boy who's, like, so high in the air on the top of the wheel.
Yeah, these are in Syria, aren't they?
Yeah. Yeah, this is a good example of the one tiny person in the photo rule. There was one other one I wanted to talk about, which is these, like, towers, these ventilating towers in Hyderabad in Pakistan, which are this sort of kite-shaped chimney which catches the prevailing wind and funnels it down into the house.
Slightly reminiscent of a world totally taken over by satellite dishes. Yeah. Or now, you know, the solar-powered hot water things. If you go around hot places, like, everyone's got the cylinder and the roof-mounted solar-powered water heater.
Maybe a bit... one of the things we might go on to talk to, possibly in the bonus material, is... where this the kind of modern study of vernacular architecture goes next. And definitely one of the places that it goes to is the study of alternative techniques of kind of atmospheric regulation, you know, heating and cooling, the types of technologies which have been developed in places like this.
And then we have famous Indian observatories, defensive and religious towers. But one is like a minaret. It's like minaret, fortified tower. I don't know what that one. I don't know the middle one. What is it?
The middle one's in Baghdad.
Do you know what the middle one is? I don't know it.
It's a tomb.
The pictures of movable architecture. This is a really funny and extremely tendentious one. There's like some people with what look very much like coracles to me, but he's pretending they're houses. There's some people moving a little reed roof. Yeah. The one with four guys like standing, resting the roof on their heads is very strange. What do you think's going on there?
He doesn't say. It's in Guinea. What is it? It's a sort of thatchy roof.
It feels like an important person stands in the middle and they walk around with him underneath.
Ah, yeah, that seems probable, doesn't it?
That's like, what it seems
four,
like to me.
They're four strong young men who are sort of positioned at the cardinal points of this roof.
It's totally bogus. He doesn't have any like yurts or anything. The type of moving architecture he wants is the one that is an entirely assembled house, which people just walk around in. The quality of images throughout is really good.
What do you think it's meant to achieve?
I think that reframing. I think it's meant to blow open what he sees as a cosy, closed-minded view of architecture as this modernist project or Beaux-Arts project or academy. He wants to blow open the academy.
Yeah. I can't help feeling that it's not even really addressed to architects, that in some way it's really its target are middle-class Americans. And I think that his affect, because he has quite an accessible way of talking and of explaining things, that he's the sort of kind of artist or bohemian, I mean, I know he's really Moravian, but like, who talking to the staid bourgeois and trying to kind of awaken them.
I think we should, before we talk about his motive, we should go through his life. Like so many other people, he is born in small town Moravia in the Grand Austro-Hungarian Empire. Is it 1905 he's born? I think into a German-speaking family, into a mixed-speaking population. Moves to be educated to Vienna, where he studies at what was a pretty prestigious but very Beaux-Arts course. He's very good at drawing. We have seen images. And there was a broad Beaux-Arts curriculum which he was highly critical of. He goes, while he's there on trips, I think before he goes off to do his master's, he goes around Turkey and Anatolia. Probably by then, the new Ataturk Turkey, which is probably liberalised after the peace. Comes back, does his master's, then goes off to Greece, where he examines in the Greek islands these curved houses, which actually had been done by various people before. I think Joseph Hoffman had really liked them. As you can see how early modernists who like sort of white-rendered curved things would like these white-rendered barrel-vaulted houses. And so there was a bit of looking for them.
By this point, he was also working in Berlin and also in Vienna. And he travelled an awful lot, but when he gets to Santorini, that also then became the subject of his PhD.
So he's done a lot of university. Like, he's done lots of university and lots of institutions. Yeah. And he's good at being in institutions and getting grants and stuff.
Yeah, and during his doctoral research, he painted these really beautiful little watercolours, which I've put a few of them up, of, this kind of terrain of little vaulted roofs and things, and the way in which they are silhouetted against the sea and against the landscape.
In a style which he got out of the academy, I think. I think he underrepresents both what he got from Moravia and from Vienna. Vienna wasn't nearly as close-minded. I mean, just think of the people who were there at the time.
So we're up to about sort of early 30s now.
About 1932, moves to Italy, where he starts to particularly work with one architect, I forget the name of.
He works with a guy called Luigi Cosenza, and there's a series of these house projects which are...
Before that, they work on some large competitions for the fascists, for public buildings, and the design of some towns, I think, all of which they fail. but they do get some small residential projects.
Which we'll talk about in a little bit.
Yeah, yeah. Worth he works on a series.
Yeah, so he was working there through the mid-30s.
Coming and going on various travels.
Yeah, he met his wife. Yeah, who's very important.
What's it? A liberated woman who goes barefoot and wears uncut cloth, I think was his description or something like that.
Yeah, that's very much what he's into.
He's also going back to Austria quite a bit. And I think starts to spend more time there, but also spends time on the islands around the Bay of Naples, which he's fascinated by. Then the position in Europe becomes a bit more difficult. Hitler's getting busy. Fascist Italy is becoming a bit more problematic as well. Yeah. But after the Anschluss, he gets a bit worried that he's going to get called up. Yeah. And so he goes to Brazil.
Yes, I mean, he lived in Argentina and Brazil, and then ended up in Brazil, in São Paulo, for a couple of years, designing furniture, fabric, houses.
Most of his architectural projects are in Brazil, actually, I think by number. In terms of production, that's where he did quite a few, and also started to get successful in São Paulo culture, edited magazines, produced exhibitions.
So there's this mysterious thing which it says here, travels to the United States as one of the Latin American prize winners for garden furniture designs of the Organic Design Competition. That's in 1941, which I think is when he comes into contact with the Museum of Modern Art, and that's where this, I think that in fact that that's the occasion where he has this first conversation with the museum about doing an exhibition of vernacular architecture. I don't understand what it means, an organic design competition, and I don't have never seen the garden furniture in question.
Yeah.
But if anyone has it, it would be interested. Given that it's this very decisive point in his life, it would be quite nice to know what that happened to be.
He'd done quite a... There'd been magazine articles on him. At the beginning of the war, people in America decided they should write, because they couldn't go to Europe anymore. A few people decided to go to Latin America and look at what was going on there. And I think he was quite compatible. And eventually that leads to him being able to get into America. Because he has some difficulty at this point, because he's stateless. He renounces Austrian citizenship because he doesn't want to get called up, but doesn't really have any alternative ones. But he manages to get into the United States with institutional support in the early 40s. Does quite a lot of writing there.
And then in 44, there's this first exhibition.
The first exhibition, Our Clothes Modern, which was part of their modern series, which was like, you know, modern gardens, modern houses,
yes.
modern furniture.
Yeah, modern interior design, modern something. Yeah,
and he does one, Our Clothes Modern, which is a sort of attack on clothes.
Yeah.
Western clothes.
Yeah, and it's quite funny, but it's very strange.
It's satirical, like, why have you got so many buttons? Yeah. Why have you got so many pockets?
I mean, are clothes modern? I think the answer is no.
For him, they're certainly not.
They're not modern because they're too silly. They're too cultured. The exhibitions at this time are consciously didactic. They were understood that way. They were going to be about educating the public and kind of telling them about the new modern way of doing things.
They weren't shrinking violets, were they? We've discussed a few of them by now, and they tend to not be afraid of saying...
So he does this funny thing. There's sort of an image of on the wall of, like, a guy in his suit, and then there's this, like, hanging, glass plane, which just shows all the buttons. And then there's another one in front which just shows all the pockets. And the buttons on their own, I think he intended people to kind of see this rather absurd profusion of fasteners, which in his retelling is sort of like kind of covering yourself in, like, jewels or something. It's kind of this strange and rather savage form of ornamentation, which we only don't question because we're so used to it.
Does it also include the picture of the two New Guinean gentlemen, well-attired New Guinean gentlemen, or wherever they're from, who are wearing their penis tubes?
Yeah, well, so here, this is, I think, slightly uncomfortable, but the rhetoric here is, the title is, Every Modern Style Has a Jungle Counterpart. And apologies if this is a bit racist. And so then it has, like, a picture of a woman wearing a fashionable dress with something called a fan bustle, which is this sort of swag of material over her behind.
But the funny thing is, fan bustles were, like,
Weren't these very fashionable in like the 1880s?
Oh, I don't know. Someone who knows more could tell me. And then on the left, it has a woman in the Congo who has this sort of strange kind of rigid elliptical thing which is covering her bum. And then to the right of that, it has a Victorian woman with one of those like very built out like back things that makes it look like you have an enormous bum. And then next to it, it has a kind of ink drawing of a woman from Africa with a hypertrophy of the buttocks, which means that she in fact does have an enormous bum.
There was great interest in these in this idea in the late 18th century in England, and
so I think that you can sort of discern the method of argument which is going on here, which is maybe not
civilization and savagery are the same.
The rhetoric only works if you have quite a conventional, at the time, view of what savagery consists in.
A lot of his images of civilization are Victorian. No one was wearing... I mean, perhaps people were wearing giant bustles, but I don't think they were.
On this occasion, actually, he did put his critique into a kind of practice and designed not only a series of clothes, but also his real passion, which is for ladies' footwear. I could describe the clothes quickly because I've got some pictures of them. But essentially, his idea was that the thing which was wrong with modern tailoring is that you cut the cloth up into too many pieces, and that, like the toga, it should be worn in as large a piece as possible. It's a very small picture of a collection of... So he had a company called Bernardo, and this is Bernardo Separates. These clothes for women, sort of dressing gown, tunic, skirt, very bold, graphical, big stripes.
He was very partial to a spot of tie-dye as well. And the sort of wax relief printing, or wax like resist printing as well.
Is this also the exhibition where there's the bit where you have to take your shoes off and walk around? Because he has a real polemic about shoes and how he thinks that they distort and deform the feet of...
Yes, he says that Western shoes, you should have your big toe in the middle.
Logically, you would have the big toe in the middle.
Rather, he's done a series of plaster models of what women's bodies would look like if they filled the clothes that they wore.
So I think it is this exhibition where they created this kind of rough, textured sort of plaster floor, which you were meant to take your shoes and socks off and walk around on it and experience the particular pleasure. There's in a later project where he imagines his ideal house and his ideal client. It's the woman, as you say, wearing her uncut fabric, walking barefoot all over the different surfaces of the house. He's got a thing, doesn't he? Yeah. Ladies' feet, but particularly his wife's feet. She was Berta was the official foot model for Bernardo sandals. I mean, having a thing about feet is very, very, very respectable kink to have. And I think if you can parlay it into a very successful, footwear company, then all power to you.
The sandal designs tend to be reworkings of archetypical sandals. So he does flip flops. Greco-Roman style ones, but sort of paired back a bit. They're thin, the straps
like
are thin.
Thin braided leather straps. When I was putting some stuff on Instagram, I did like the hat, you know, you can do the hashtags. And the difference between the Bernard Rudofsky hashtag and the Bernardo sandals hashtag is the difference between 262 and 700,000.
Well, Instagram is the location of desire, not the intellect. Anyway, we've got slightly lost, so we've got to the... I think we should do the whole life.
I think it's important. I think the foot fetish is an important part of the...
Well, he's a general sensualist. He also writes a lot about food. He's even more of a food snob than me.
Yes, I believe that in the arts and in architecture, the sensuous pleasures should come before the intellectual ones. It's one of his quotations.
Okay, so he's in America for a few years because he doesn't have a passport, apart from anything else.
But the Bernardo sandals got going in the mid-40s.
Carried on going for the rest of his life.
He's a significant figure in the history of popular footwear.
They'd been an absolutely not thing, and they'd sort of started, I guess, in the 20s and 30s, hadn't they? Kind of slight, is a slightly modernist thing. Also, yeah, sort of Fabian. It's a Fabian stereotype as well. Left-wing intellectuals in England wore sandals in the 30s, 20s and 30s, satirised in Just William, I think.
I think in the late 40s he gets American citizenship, and then a couple of years after that he goes for a few years to live in Japan.
Later. So he was living in Japan in the late 50s, but although he'd made some trips before that.
And he travels pretty extensively in Japan, and writes a book about it, The Kimono of the Mind. It sort of talks lovingly about bits of Japanese culture and then mercilessly takes the piss out of them, which I think disappoints people. Like, see, you know, Architecture Without Architects, and they think this great sort of expansive person, and people are well into Japanese culture, and then they, you know, try and find this book, and then they find it's just, it's interesting accounts, and then him just, like, taking the piss out of them and saying... Then, when's Behind the Picture Window?
So that's before that. That's in the mid-50s, and then, yeah, then...
So Behind the Picture Window is a book which, again, I've only read excerpts of, but it's a real attack on sort of the new American life, which is both, like, suburban living with cars and conveniences. He's really against, like, mod cons, or some of them. Although it's worth saying all the way through, he believes in air conditioning, and he really dislikes what he would regard as ineffective cooking, tasteless kitchens, but also has problems with advertising. And also he is very suspicious of American culture's politics of control and surveillance. There may be a little bit of sort of anti-McCarthyism underneath, but in the same way that, like, I'm not entirely sure what the fortifications is about. It seems to be more about just taking the piss out of, like, suburban housewives as well, more than anything else.
And then, I mean, the rest of his life is this sort of series of further books and exhibitions.
The area which we haven't dealt with is he has a general study of life and something that he has multiple books on. They will be divided up by, like, eating, sleeping. In each section he will say the natural way of these things has been perverted, and each of these things should be, you know, you should only sleep on the ground. You should eat lying down. Cutlery, you should eat lying down with just your hands. Cutlery is like, a fork is an implement for moving dung, which has somehow got into the, you know, and like he's got a thing about, like, we've sublimated violence somehow, but we still have weapons at the table. Rocking chairs and swings are either sex toys or aids to masturbation, which have somehow, like, as sex has become more sublimated in our society. And those things, we can just say he, like, continues on all those other topics through the rest of his life and continues to do exhibitions around about that sort of thing in America, largely. And I wanted to add, I mean, I've very strongly sort of said various strange things that he's suggested, but he never sort of actually says or makes explicit that he doesn't say that everyone should do this stuff, and he just spends a lot of time pointing up things that he thinks are wrong. For the most part, isn't prepared to be nailed down. On one hand, in one of his books, he will take the mick out of something, and then later on propose it as a very good thing. Yeah. So a lot of things he takes from Japan, I think, I'm slightly having to extrapolate this, but the way he describes bathing, the ideal of bathing, is very Japanese, where you bathe, you wash first and then bathe communally and socially.
Which is great, it's fun, I like it.
And it should be a sort of joyous social thing.
It's not that joyous, having done it in Japan. The experience of doing it is that the ones I've done it in are like sex segregated, which is the norm. More bohemian ones, maybe you can mix it up a bit. My experience is, as a man, yeah, you do the, like, or the washing thing, you get in, and then you sit in silence while you listen faintly, often like over a wall, to the sound of all of the women talking to each other in the women's one. But in the men's one, no one talks.
To talk is not really a male quality, is it? But I guess the point about Bernard is that, or Rudofsky, I should always be talking about people in their surnames, I suppose that's the convention,
Bernard,
isn't it?
We can call him Bernard. This is new media. The rules don't really apply in the same way.
He's not prepared to be pinned down, and I think he sees it as a virtue to always attack. And actually, he's still pretty attached to a lot of modern... He doesn't believe in going back to the ancients. He likes some mod cons.
No, he's a, like, sceptical modernist, isn't he? He's a provocateur. He's
got a big line that houses should be instruments for living and not machines, but I don't really know what that means.
But we can have a go at working it out next.
We could talk a little bit about, he did work on a few houses. Well, quite a few, actually, during his lifetime. Which constitute a bit of a vision for the good life, for his kind of version of it. I think the two we'd talk about probably are the Prosider House and the Niveller House, which are from, I think, sort of mid-30s and early 60s, respectively. No, maybe the Niveller one is earlier, I think 50s. And the Prosider one, he wrote this kind of accompanying, like, commentary, which talks about the way in which it's intended to be used. Let's start in the bathroom. The room for bathing has no fixtures. A depression in the floor collects water for the bath. The morning sun comes in through the open door. The toilet fixtures are confined to the adjoining room. The courtyard is the real living room. Its floor is formed by a lawn with little daisies and veronica. In spring there will be violets and orchids. The sky, with its endlessly changing appearance, serves as a ceiling. One can protect oneself against the summer sun with a length of canvas. A fireplace allows for lingering there in the evenings, during the spring and even the autumn. Dogs, cats and doves will find refuge here. Before entering the bedroom, where the floor is composed entirely of mattresses, one removes one's shoes in the dressing room. A mosquito net that hangs from the ceiling protects against mosquitoes and flies. The kitchen is electric. The meals are completely prepared here so that one does not have to do any work at the table. The dining room, open toward both the courtyard and the garden, does not have a table or chairs, but it contains one or more couches on which to recline. They form a bi- or triclinium around a small serving table. With this arrangement, the architect solves a number of problems that we have accepted without question. First of all, bad digestion and corpulence. Not to mention the aesthetics. The music room also serves during inclement weather as a living room. Along one wall, there is a built-in couch that can serve as a bed for one or two guests. And just to say something about the plan, so it's a basically not quite square plan, where all of the... There's a single row of rooms which are arranged around a square patio in the centre of the plan, which is sort of open at one side, so that there's an entrance. This creates a threshold on one side.
The indoor-outdoor space is very closed off. It's a tight... wall, you know, courtyard that's in the middle. And there will also be a patio. So he does houses which are both patio houses where there is a patio on one side and courtyard houses where there's a courtyard in the middle. I would say essentially all his houses are one or other of those. It's either a single central courtyard, possibly with a patio on one edge, or they are built into a landscape with a patio which might be raised like a terrace.
The Casa d'Oro in Naples, which is one of the houses he built during his Italian period, has its back to the hillside.
It's amazing. It's built capping this cliff. It's got this fantastic...
And again, it's almost like a single, in this case slightly curving plan, like a single thickness of rooms, and then these different patios which are coming out.
That one's interesting because some of it is built down, or rather they sort of extend the cliff up with a retaining wall and have rooms in that. Yeah. And it's somewhat free section. I haven't seen a very convincing section of it yet. It's multi-leveled, whereas most of his buildings are bungalows. I disagree with him. I think the first floor is the best floor.
It depends on the climate a bit.
First floor is best for most climates.
I think they both have things to be said for them.
Yeah, the ones above that, I'm not sure have much to be said for them, except the view occasionally. Yeah. Be nice to... Yeah, you have a sort of low one, and then you have a, like, tower that you go to the top of and survey your estates while eating dainties.
You could detect various things in that, can't you? You can... There's the idea that history has much to tell us about the right way to live. One thing that he's reacting very strongly against is the house of kind of gadgets, isn't it?
Yeah, but it's an all-electric kitchen.
The all-electric kitchen is a way to... It's a strategy of simplification, isn't it? But yeah, you know, the stone bed. I feel like the stone bed is... or the built-in stone wall couch.
Yeah, but the stone bed's funny because it's like the whole floor is carved out of the bedrock, it seems, covered in mattresses. Yeah. But a lot of that is... That house is also, it's a classic Mediterranean house and modernist. Having the very closed courtyard is sort of specific to him. It's funny because it's also very defensible, isn't it, this shape? As well, I was trying to get to something with fortification and troglodytism and moving the house away. He's someone who is a conscious cosmopolitan who said,
don't need roots. My roots are like an air plant. I suffocate by staying in a place for too long. But actually, you can also see from the story and the works that he is tremendously influenced by everywhere he goes and tremendously influenced by his youth and the culture that he grew up in.
But his vision of the home is this self-contained world. It is this fortress turned in on itself. An open-minded woman cannot wear designer clothes, hats and shoes in her own house. What does she wear?
Uncut cloth.
A tunic.
Yeah.
And no shoes.
That's what all open-minded women must do.
So there's another... He did this post-war house, which I know much less about, but which has this very singular poetic moment, the Nivola house, which has where there's a tree and there's this white wall, and they've like cut a hole in the wall to admit one of the branches of the tree, so that there's this kind of interlacing. Well, I mean,
they've built the wall around the tree.
Yeah, the interlacing of the architecture and nature.
Buildings aren't very well published. He actually did quite a few, but it's a bit difficult without being able to either go to them. I haven't seen a colour photograph of one of his buildings. Have you seen a colour photograph of one of his buildings?
I'm not sure I have.
I've seen colour, like watercolour paintings of them. He's a very confusing guy. I'd really recommend looking at the books starting with Architecture Without Architects, because the images are deeply attractive. And I think it's a good indoctrination of the young. It is very expansive in its definition of architecture.
They're wonderful images and beautiful and poetic. At the same time, they're all kind of weightless. They're kind of disconnected from the sort of facts which have led to their creation, the process by which they've been made, by which they've negotiated, the length of time over which they've accreted. Often what you're seeing are the kind of emergent results of process which is very accidental or which involves a certain amount of like antagonism, but which is just presented as a kind of tectonic possibility.
The product is the image. Is the photograph, and a key point in the development of that is the act of taking the photograph. I may be criticising him a lot because I feel that no one who takes him seriously, or not many people who take him seriously, have been prepared to pick up on the fact that there are two things I found very problematic about him, and one of them is his relationship to culture. I find very problematic. He doesn't care about the cultures that brings a lot of this stuff about.
I mean, it's sort of a moot point whether he cares or not, but they're like stripped away in the presentation.
And in doing so, deliberately gets rid of the humanity of a lot of the stuff, actually. As in the messy business of people, societies, how people actually relate to each other, how things actually come into being.
It's this totally idiosyncratic and uncontextual engagement with the source material, but I think that that's fine as a thing to exist in the world, and it's a kind of a sort of rewarding frame to slip into this rootless, unmoored way of looking at things which you sort of deliberately don't understand or don't try to understand. He obviously does have lots of ideas about houses, but the house is something which only really comes into focus as like a single thing. When towns appear, was it one of the books we haven't talked about, is he does have this book about like streets. And I think he definitely has a strong idea about the communal spaces of cities. If this was like a manifesto, you would have to join the dots between these things. But you can't join the dots between like a detached courtyard house in a landscape and a sort of dense urban fabric which has a particular kind of strong relationship to landscape. I mean, leave aside the like limited edge thing for now. Like the conditions of what those houses and the sort of places that he went to do his doctoral research, for example, it's a really different sort of experience. That's partly why I find myself coming back to this idea of him like addressing the American middle class, because he's very much addressing people who own their own detached house. He doesn't really, to me, seem to have a vision which is capable of addressing like the collective, like the mass house.
I mean, culture is a collective activity. He's not interested in like history, culture, societies, their function very much, or like whole chunks of it. He's just willing to say that that sort of collective activity is irrelevant or stupid. And he doesn't like the idea that things are product of like collective action in somehow, unless it's sort of like scenic and incredibly distant.
But that's just the necessity of being the kind of iconoclast, isn't it? When everyone else, you know, everyone goes to the fun fair together, and you kind of have to say, you have to say, well, you know, what we're really doing here is like expressing our wish to be annihilated or something, you know, like that.
Yeah,
that's
guy's humane. He can show up some hypocrisy, and he can say that to be in touch with the senses is good, and that includes the sort of immediately social.
I think that there's also something which is that there's a like mysterious resonance which the buildings in Architecture Without Architects have, which is that, you know, he doesn't tell you anything about their inhabitants, but as a series of images, they are expressive, a sort of strange diversity, ingenuity, resilience. What you read into it is an organic community. You see this hillside peppered with little openings, each one standing in for the body which it would admit. So you have like immediately like an image of like a set of people. You have the sort of vertiginous quality of the landscape itself, and then you read that sort of leads to a kind of reading of these people as kind of intrepid, I guess.
Yeah, amazing spirit.
Yeah.
These difficult places that people are.
They're literally living in this, like, upthrusting, mountainous form, which has, like, a very long and pretty established spiritual kind of significance, doesn't it? Like, the mountain is a, like, geistig signifier. I mean, you read very strongly in when you see these towns which are built on a hillside and in which every successive house is kind of nestled against but slightly below its neighbour. I mean, that already it's kind of implied in the way I'm describing it, but there's a literal structural relationship between one and the next. If you were to demolish certain ones, you would cause a bit of a problem because they are probably all to some extent buttressing each other analogically, you know. Yeah, but they're open to the, even if you know what how they were really made, they're open to a very different sort of reading as a formal metaphor, aren't they? Because they look like all these buildings kind of huddled together, all touching shoulders.
Because those places are more complicated than that, and there's a reason they're empty now. They were dependent on a very specific sort of society, which was in lots of ways, which was to do with control and lots of things. What you see, the image isn't, as an outsider, is different to you. Then you learn more and more about it, and the meaning of it changes, and the way you see it changes.
Yeah, I was thinking of those towns, those like amazing hill towns that people lived in Sicily, for example, but which was dependent. They were almost like prison camps in a sense, like everybody.
Yeah, there were two things. They were fortified, and then there were these labour armies. There were these sort of serf armies, which actually you get around basically the whole of the Mediterranean, southern Spain, southern Italy.
That's the kind of mimetic faculty, isn't it? That's the ability to see.
And it's lovely. It's lovely to be able to do it. But I think it's very important. I think it's good to temper that. You've got to temper that.
Instead of saying that it's not cultural, I think you could say also that it's unhistoric, which can also be very liberating in a certain way. The deliberate misunderstanding of things, I think, can be productive as long as you're conscious that that's, or you're going to become conscious at some point that that's what's going on.
There are people for which each of these things does have meaning as well. And those meanings are like the real core of life that he is so insistent on. But they're not just the nice things. Yeah. You can't just have your sweets. You can't just have your sex, food and outside house and complain that other people also want to pray and be angry.
It's like a suppression of so many sides of life.
Well, if you, what would happen if you were to take his like dream house and try and turn it into a city? And actually, you'd be like, well, they can't be right next to each other because it kind of messes it up. So maybe we're into this kind of broadacre city sort of territory where we need to have them everywhere. But then, like, how's everyone getting around? Where does the money come from? Then it's, you know, we're having cars, but suddenly there are roads. I don't think he believes in having roads everywhere. So and then you know, what are we going to, where are the sources of industry, how are we going to distribute this on the land? Yeah, so it unravels. Well, that's fine. It's just this sort of sensual, like, and mythically charged vision of what the good life is. I think it's got a lot to recommend it, in spite of everything. It is interesting. I wonder if any of the listeners have a very specific mythic, like, dream house archetype, or if there's another one that we should, that makes a kind of natural comparison to this one.
I would really love, I'm gagging for a greenhouse on the roof. That's my thing. I would make it so good. I'm really into it.
Well, thank you very much for listening.
It was lovely. It was a bit of a romp rather than a...
We've got a few other things to talk about, which we will do on the sequel.
It's the B film. It's the, like... I imagine it is the little, you know... Yeah, yeah. Appendix A.
Yeah, the appendix. Oh, God. Yeah, well, join us for that.
Yeah, it's what is appended.
Yes. And please have a look at the Patreon at patreon.com/about_buildings. We will be posting quite a lot of stuff for this episode on Instagram at @about_buildings.
Sorry, I'm just imagining this. Yeah, main episode is called colon.
Yeah.
It's called appendix.
Appendix. My cabin of dreams. At the ending of day, I start wending my way with a heart feeling gay to my cabin of dreams. Swinging down through the lane, singing love's old refrain, I'll be home once again. Tapping my window pane, when I open the door, I'm in heaven once more with the one I adore in my cabin of dreams.